You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 13th of February 2019 on Monocle 24. Live from Midori House in London, this is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up, 44 days until Brexit, and is it possible that overheard Brussels bar chat is the best idea we have of what's actually going to happen? Also ahead, given that the last US government shutdown was other than an outstanding success, why is President Donald Trump courting another one? We'll look at an unlikely but growing diplomatic spat between China and New Zealand, and we'll speak to James Hamilton Patterson, no less, about his new book chronicling Britain's decline as a manufacturing power. And
all the songs are very special for me because they represent different periods of my life. But of course, Maschinada continues to be the biggest hit, and we closed the show with that, and people dancing, and just a wonderful party and celebration of life.
We'll hear from the Brazilian bossa nova legend Sergio Mendes. All that and more coming up on the Monocle Daily, live from London, starting now. And welcome to tonight's Monocle Daily with me, Andrew Muller. It's now 44 days until the United Kingdom is due to leave the European Union, and still nobody has the least idea of how that is actually going to happen. To put that into perspective, this broadcaster has personally RSVP'd to a barbecue happening further into the future than that, and which has been much better planned, although given that it's happening in Britain, there may not be anything to eat. Today, those professionally concerned with attempting to divine what in the wide world of sports is going on have been excited by an overheard statement by Chief UK Brexit negotiator Ollie Robbins that this will eventually come down to Parliament being presented with a choice between Theresa May's withdrawal deal, already once resoundingly rejected, or a delay to Brexit. I'm joined now by Carol Walker, political analyst, former BBC political correspondent. Carol, this overheard outburst, if outburst is the right word, by Ollie Robbins in a Brussels hostelry, did it actually tell us anything we didn't already know or couldn't have guessed?
Well, Andrew, Ollie Robbins is the main civil servant at the heart of the negotiations with the EU. So he certainly does have a better idea than most of us as to what is going on. But what he was suggesting was that, yes, indeed, the government was going to run down the clock until it got very close indeed to that deadline of the 29th of March when the UK is due to leave the European Union. And at that stage, Parliament would be presented with the option of either backing Theresa May's deal or facing a very long delay to departure, extending Article 50. And he expressed optimism that at that stage, that's something that the EU would agree to. But this is really just another twist in this extraordinary drama that is still unfolding. As you say, 44 days to go till Brexit, and still no clear agreement on the terms of that departure. And indeed, Donald Tusk, the president of the European Council tonight, was tweeting that he's still waiting for concrete, realistic proposals from London on how to break the Brexit impasse.
So is the scenario we're being invited to countenance here that Theresa May, or the Prime Minister, that is essentially playing chicken with Parliament?
Well, it certainly has been a sense of who's going to blink first amongst the many different factions in Parliament. And Theresa May has gone from trying to woo over the Labour Party, the main opposition party, some of its MPs. She's veered back towards trying to win over the hardliners on her side. She's veered backwards and forth. And tomorrow she faces yet another, what could be, very difficult session in Parliament. 2 weeks ago, Theresa May said that by tomorrow she'd come back to Parliament. She would by then have sorted out some alternative arrangements to the Northern Ireland backstop, which many people object to, which is part of the withdrawal agreement, and that MPs would then have a further chance to put down amendments. We now know that actually she's coming back having achieved virtually nothing over the last 2 weeks. There's still no agreement on how to replace the Northern Ireland backstop, which is intended to prevent a hard border in Northern Ireland. But she's facing more trouble than we'd thought. We thought that this could be a pretty low-key event tomorrow. But it now seems that because the government's motion essentially says that the Commons reiterates its support to the approach set out 2 weeks ago and notes that the discussions on the backstop are ongoing, the problem was that the other thing that happened 2 weeks ago was that an amendment passed which effectively ruled out a no-deal Brexit. So the hardline Brexiteers in her party are now up in arms over that and threatening to vote against the Prime Minister tomorrow. Now, that wouldn't actually scupper her deal. It wouldn't actually affect the negotiations. But if Theresa May has to go back to the European Union, having faced yet another defeat, it will further undermine her prospects of being able to say to them, look, I've got something that I could get through the Commons if only you'll give me some changes to the backstop.
Is it therefore the case, if what Ollie Robbins is claimed to have overheard being said is an accurate insight into the Prime Minister's thinking, can we at least divine that, at least as the Prime Minister sees it, no deal is just not an option?
Well, look, at the moment, the default position is that Britain will leave on March the 29th. And unless something else happens between now and then, if there is no deal, we'll leave with no deal. And all these attempts to put down amendments, non-binding amendments that say we shouldn't leave without a deal are not going to prevent that happening. But what you have got is there are plans by another group of Labour MPs with the backing of some Conservative MPs to force a vote that would essentially give MPs the chance to seize the agenda in Parliament, push through their own bill, their own legislation, which would then say that if time was running out and there wasn't a deal, the government would have to seek an extension to Article 50. But even if that was passed, if the vote went through, if Parliament MPs seized control, passed this bill, and Theresa May went back to the EU27, unless they can see a good reason for it, they don't necessarily have to agree to an extension of Article 50. To get this departure delayed, you've got to have the agreement of all EU countries. If they're not prepared to give it, if they think it's simply prolonging the uncertainty and there's no further prospect of a deal, even if they do delay, well, then it's by no means a given that that extension would be granted. So we really are in hugely uncharted waters here.
Is it the case, however, that even if, say, for example, Parliament just buckled tomorrow or whenever it can next buckle and just gave Theresa May assent to her deal, even if that happened, and as you've just made clear, that's really pretty unlikely, is it actually even possible that everything that needs to be done can be done before March 29th?
Well, look, you're right. There's an absolutely huge challenge to get all the legislation through, even if a deal were to be signed, sealed and delivered tomorrow, which it's not going to be. It would be incredibly difficult to get the legislation through. I think if a deal had been agreed with the EU and the UK then said to them, look, we need another month, another couple of months to get this legislation through, under those circumstances, I think that it's very unlikely that the EU would reject that demand. They would almost certainly agree to a short-term extension. I think what they are less likely to do is to agree to an extension just because nothing's been agreed and if there's still no prospect of an agreement. So, yes, it's a hugely challenging position. And every day that passes takes the UK closer to that no-deal Brexit, which so many businesses, so many different organisations are warning would cause huge difficulties, huge problems in terms of supplies, of food, of medicines, of getting goods in and out of the country. Now, the Brexiteers all say, well, this would be a short-term disruption and at least we'd be out the other side and we could then be free to negotiate new free trade deals. But I don't think that anyone thinks that a no-deal Brexit is ideal. This country's rules, regulations and laws have been so closely interwoven with those of the EU for decades that to suddenly switch out of those arrangements would undoubtedly cause huge disruption across the country, at least in the short term.
Carol Walker, thank you as always for joining us. You're listening to The Daily. This is the Monocle Daily with me, Andrew Muller. It was widely assessed that the recent 35-day shutdown of the US federal government was a tactical disaster for President Donald Trump, that it accomplished nothing, that nobody really understood what it was supposed to accomplish in the first place, that it handed a win to the incoming Democratic House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, and that it did not endear the Republican Party to the hundreds of thousands of federal employees marooned without salaries. Even by Trumpian standards, then, it's hard to divine what might the president would see in permitting or encouraging another shutdown, but here we appear to be. Well, I'm joined now with more on this by Pema Levy, a reporter for Mother Jones. Pema, is this the same argument as last time? Has it moved on at all?
No, I don't think it's moved on at all, actually. I think we're in a situation like before where a government shutdown is not popular, particularly one that is in furtherance of an unpopular policy, which the wall is unpopular. And yet you have a president who's won his election and continues to drive all of his political power through activating his base. So he is going for a smaller, section of the electorate. And so, the reason we're even wondering if we're going to shut down again is basically sitting around wondering, if Donald Trump is going to turn on Fox News on Friday morning, hear someone say that he's a wimp, and decide not to sign legislation to keep the government open.
We will come back to the intricacies of that legislation, but you mentioned there his base, and obviously the wall and the notion that Mexico would pay for it. They're high on Donald Trump's list of his greatest hits at this point. Those are the surefire bankers to wheel out at the encore at any of his rabble-rousing set pieces. Is there any indication at all that that base are beginning to get at all impatient, that it has been now 2 years since Trump was president or has been president, and that wall remains obstinately unbuilt?
I actually don't. And I think what's interesting here, and and you see this when you get focus groups or interviews with some of his most ardent supporters, is that I think they all sort of knew that the wall was sort of symbolic. It's such a monumental task to actually build, hundreds of miles of wall in the desert. I think on some level, everyone sort of knew that it was sort of symbolic and that he was really just signaling, I'm for you, right? That these people are bad and I'm on your side. And I think that he was messaging that. So I actually think that the fact that the wall is not there does not perturb them, and that the fact that he's still, pushing for it, and that he's pushing here for billions of dollars to build it, because clearly the fact that Mexico is going to pay for it was a fantasy. But I think what he's doing is, one, he doesn't want to sort of give up on the fiction. But two, it's the symbolism of it. It's the symbolism of, really exploiting, the racial politics of the United States and fear of immigrants, and sort of building on that and having a divisive campaign that says, I'm for you, largely white people, and not for immigrants who are largely brown people in this context. And so I don't think that the actual absence of the wall is a problem for him. I think that symbolically he has to continue to appear like he is, defending his base and therefore his base.
Do you think, that is a plausible hypothesis. It casts Trump in the role, I guess, as a preacher to some obdurately fanatical sect, which is a reasonable enough comparison. But if his supporters have internalized the wall as kind of a metaphor, do you think Trump has as well? Or do you think he genuinely thinks it's ever going to get built?
I think it's an interesting question. I think on some level he hasn't. I think, he is someone who came into fame as being in construction, as being in real estate. I think he likes to build structures and slap his name on them. And so I think that, you know, the wall appealed to him. It was something his advisors suggested he say, and he really ran with it because I think he liked that sort of concrete feel to it, pun intended, I guess. So I do think on some level, you know, he feels like it's not just a metaphor. And certainly it's something that stands in for, you know, his whether or not he's going soft, you know, whether or not he still is the person who he was in 2016, whether or not Washington has changed him or he's still, you know, the bombastic guy that's going to stand up for, you know, the forgotten American. So it has that meaning for who he is as president. But I think that Donald Trump probably really wants the wall to actually happen and to put his name on it.
Well, if we descend from the realm of the metaphysical then back to actual workaday politics, do we know how wide the gap is between what Trump actually wants, or at least what Trump would agree to sign, and what is on offer?
Yeah, I think that what's on offer right now is much less than he wanted, much less than he was holding out for when he shut down the government in December. It's about $1.3 billion for a small amount of barrier. And I think that, you know, Trump is sort of preparing to sign it, but not concede that it's a concession, because he's preparing to, you know, do some sort of executive order or executive action that would take unused funds from other parts of the government and then redirect them to a wall. I think that the legality of that would be immediately tested in court. But I think that, you know, one way to get out of another shutdown but still not, you know, technically cave would be to say, well, I'll take this $1.3 billion, even though it's not the $5.7 I wanted, but I'm going to go find the rest of that money somewhere else in the budget.
Do you think he's daunted, though, by the prospect of another shutdown? Did it get through to him that the last one did not go well for him?
I think that it did, yes. But as I mentioned before, he is someone who seems to make snap judgments and snap decisions. He seems to move out of emotion. And so I think, you know, the danger here is until something is signed, this is a president who could change his mind, you know, who could read an article, who could turn on Fox News, who could have, you know, an advisor come in and say, don't sign this. And if that's the last advisor that talks to him before the bill gets to his desk, he might not sign it. We've seen that, in reporting from how this administration operates. And so I think that, you know, yes, he got the message that wasn't great for him. But I think he, on some level, you know, lives in a reality where what he needs is adoration from his base and commitment from his base. And so if that's the most important people for you, then you might do something that ultimately is not very popular with everyone else.
Well, further to that point, then, is it possible then for Trump, because most politicians see, or at least you hope they see, conflict negotiation like this as a means to an end, that it gets them to the thing they're trying to accomplish, the law they're trying to get passed, even the wall they're trying to get built. Is it possible for Trump that what a lot of people are still missing, that for him the conflict is the point, that it's the end rather than the means?
Yeah, I think that to a degree that is an issue. I think that, but I think that he's sort of losing on that issue. So I think that for a while, there was a consensus probably among both parties that the more we talked about immigration, the more that was just generally bad for Democrats and good for Republicans, and that we were keeping the dialogue in a place that generally tended to favor Republicans. But I think that with all of the focus on the wall and the family separation tragedies that we've seen over the last year along the southern border, I think all of that has really damaged. And I think that Democrats feel more confident that they can talk about the issue of immigration and not, you know, be in a losing position there. So I think that at the beginning, there probably was a sense that, you know, it's okay, we should just keep talking about immigration, and then, you know, we won't be talking about other things. But I don't know that calculus actually still holds up right now in 2019.
Pema Levy from Mother Jones, thanks as always for joining us. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24. Here are some of the other stories we're following today. At least 27 members of Iran's Revolutionary Guards have been killed in an apparent suicide bombing of their bus. The attack occurred in Sistan-Baluchistan province near Iran's border with Pakistan. A Sunni militant group, Jaish al-Adl, has claimed responsibility for the bombing. Iran's response described Jaish al-Adl as mercenaries of the intelligence services of hegemonic powers, a thinly veiled suggestion that Jaish al-Adl are acting on behalf of the United States, an accusation which seems unlikely to calm them down any. Police in the Philippines have arrested the CEO of Rappler, a news website based in Manila. Maria Ressa has been accused of something called cyber libel after publishing a report into the relationship between a prominent businessman and a judge. Originally published, however, in 2012. Certain cynical observers have suggested that the arrest of Ms. Ressa has less to do with a seven-year-old news story than it does with the fact that Rappler has been a persistent critic of Filipino President Rodrigo Duterte. And Belgium's skies have been much quieter than usual all day due to a day of national strikes called by Belgium's three major trade union federations. Short of staff in key positions, the country's air traffic agency Skies decided it had no choice but to close Belgian airports. The strikes were due to end about an hour ago. This is the Monocle Daily. You're listening to The Daily with me, Andrew Muller. One of the recurring laments of pre-Brexit Britain has been the bewailing of the UK's decline as a great manufacturer. This has been by far most often heard from the pro-leave tendency, part of their repertoire of bogus nostalgia and deluded grandeur. But it isn't entirely wrong in that it is indisputable that until quite recently Britain did make things and made them well, and that Britain ceased to do so quite suddenly and possibly avoidably. Well, that process and the reasons for it are considered in a new book by James Hamilton Patterson. Himself, it might be argued, the kind of thing that Britain used to make back when Britain used to make. Polymathic poets, novelists, historians, travel writers and foreign correspondents. I spoke to James earlier from his current residence in Austria. I wanted to start by asking about that title, The Dismantling of Great Britain. Do you think that dismantling, as you describe it, has been a deliberate process, or is it just history doing what history does?
Well, two things here. First thing is, it wasn't my subtitle. That's usually done by the department of the publisher that thinks it's going to want a good selling kind of tagline. That wasn't my idea. However, dismantling, no, I don't think it was deliberate. I don't think any country would deliberately commit suicide. And yet, you look at Brexit and you wonder. No, I think it was partly historical process, and partly genuine muddlement on successive British governments about, you know, how to deal with the future, how to deal indeed with industry of all kinds. And they just kept on getting it wrong.
So when you talk about, though, what Britain has lost, as you see it, you're writing primarily about the manufacturing sector and that golden age of British design and manufacture. Do you think that loss, though, has been primarily an economic loss, or is there a psychological, even spiritual component to it?
Oh, I think there certainly is a spiritual, if you like that word, component to it, yes. I think in some ways it's been a grievous blow, but one that's almost impossible to document. You can sort of tell by the nation's spirit at times, and certainly over Brexit, it's a kind of depression seems to rule, a kind of feeling of being lost, and the more lost people feel, the more they hark back to some imaginary glory days. It is quite depressing, I must say. I think the heart's gone out of us in some essential manner.
It's interesting that you say that, though, because as you must be aware, that nostalgia, that lament for Britain's lost manufacturing sector underpinned quite a lot of the Brexit argument and the pro-Brexit campaign, and yet you describe Brexit in your book as hastily taken, ill-informed and unthought through as decisions go. How do you square that apparent contradiction?
Oh, I think quite easily. I think, yes, I'm not myself particularly nostalgic, and indeed the book was reviewed as having been, oh, I don't know, the sort of moping and groaning of an old fart. But it's not that at all. It was actually a counterpart to my earlier book about the decline of Britain's aircraft industry. But where Brexit's concerned, I think the problem was that everything now has been seen as hinging around the referendum in 2016. And that, as far as I can see, is it was not legally binding. And if, in effect, what it was an opinion poll. And opinion polls, you know, opinions can change with more information. I just think, well, it's an established fact that both sides, Brexiteers and Remainers, were subjected to the most extraordinary amount of pre-referendum propaganda, most of it completely misleading. And I don't see any reason why one shouldn't reconsider the whole matter.
You made a reference there to your earlier book about the aerospace or the aeronautical industry in the United Kingdom, Empire of the Clouds. And the subtext of that, if I recall rightly, was that you pitched it as this conflict between Britain's buccaneering inventive tradition and the sort of rather slower-witted modern management. Do you think that has been a wider problem and that underpins the malaise you're chronicling?
Yes, I think that has been a problem. I think we've, generally speaking, British management has, and this is a wild generalisation, and I think it has been extremely bad for the most part. There are some glowing exceptions to this rule, but generally speaking, I think it has been very bad. It's a bit difficult with when we're talking about military affairs, particularly with aerospace, because, of course, that involves other countries, other alliances, other allegiances, NATO, and all the rest of it, and very tight budgets. I think national defence is a slightly separate issue. But in matters like, for example, the Britain's motorbike industry, which, you know, in the middle, up till the middle 60s, was fantastic. I mean, really, certainly up there with any other countries. But we just failed to change. We could see what was happening. Anybody could see what was happening and what they wanted. Lighter motorcycles so that men and women could ride around town and they didn't want to have to make endless repairs. And, you know, the Japanese got in there with their Honda Cub and the Italians with their mopeds. You could see what was happening, but no, we went banging on with the same old stuff. It was a real failure of management.
Is there not there an argument that Britain's evolution into a more services-oriented economy was therefore a smart response to that?
Well, I think it was a default response to that, given that the industries were failing, I mean shipbuilding and all the rest of them, and Margaret Thatcher at the time, from 79 onwards, was notoriously against the idea of heavy industry. She wasn't temperamentally suited to it at all. She didn't really like it. So, yes, it made sense to put everything into banking. My point would be it's a great mistake for any country to put all its economic eggs in one basket and to have everything depending on banking and service industry. Seems to me very, very dangerous at a time when a mixed economy shows more signs of being able to get through and stay afloat.
That idea of what Britain, I guess, could be or perhaps could have been is clearly something that's very important to you, important enough that you've written an entire book about it. But how much of your view of Britain do you think is informed by the fact that you've spent so much of your life outside it?
Oh, quite a lot. I think it's the old saw is if you really want to understand your country, you have to leave it. It does give perspective, there's no doubt about it. I have lived most of my adult life outside Britain, but with constant connections with it. Obviously, journalism once, writing generally, all my publishers there, my family is there. So I've been in constant touch with it. I know what's going on politically as well. I don't know, I think it does give one a perspective to be outside the place.
And just finally, I guess, with due acknowledgement that cure is always more complicated than diagnosis, is this a process that you see as reversible? I mean, clearly a lot of people who campaigned for Brexit argued that that would be the thing that would reverse this, but you obviously don't see it like that.
I really don't know the answer to that. I like to think it might, but I somehow doubt it. The trouble is that once you've been outside an industry for long enough, it's almost impossible to get back in because, you know, all your tools are out of date, your people are out of date, they haven't got modern training and all the rest of it. You can't just reinvent an industry. And maybe industries in this sort of era of hyper-electronics and things are no longer quite so vital.
That was James Hamilton Patterson speaking to me earlier. James's new book, What We Have Lost, The Dismantling of Great Britain, is out now, published by Head of Zeus. You're listening to The Monocle Daily. Do stay tuned. Now, every year, north of 400,000 Chinese tourists visit New Zealand. By one recent survey, the country ranks third on the wish lists of Chinese as they contemplate holiday destinations. Accordingly, 2019 is supposed to be a specially designated China-New Zealand year of tourism, but a cloud now looms over this jamboree. China has postponed the launch of the year of tourism, scheduled to occur in Wellington next week, and also punted into the weeds a planned visit to China by Kiwi Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern. This all appears to be not unrelated to New Zealand's decision to banish Chinese telecoms Leviathan Huawei from New Zealand's 5G mobile network. Well, I'm joined now by Lloyd Burr, Europe correspondent for News Hub. Lloyd, as I've explained there, I think 400,000 plus Chinese tourists to to any country, but especially a smallish one like New Zealand, is a huge deal. So how serious a shot across New Zealand's bows is this?
It's quite significant, really. I mean, it's probably the first shot across the bow that China will make. China and New Zealand's relationship is kind of fascinating. The last 10 years, our trade, two-way trade between the two countries has tripled. It's now at nearly 30 billion New Zealand dollars, which is around 15 billion pounds. So the relationship, the growth in that relationship, especially with trade, has absolutely ballooned, and it's been great for New Zealand, especially farmers. And the main thing we send over there is milk powder and increasingly now fresh milk, fresh meat, because there's a lot of Chinese there, more than a billion Chinese, and they all need feeding. And so New Zealand, as the land of milk and honey, feeds China. So there's this huge population, this huge trade relationship. And then, China sort of sees this snubbing of Huawei building the 5G network for Spark, which is probably the major telecommunications in New Zealand, as a sort of a serious snub of China and that relationship with China. So they've taken aim at tourism, I guess, as the first shot across the bow. And I think if things continue to heat up, if we don't back down or change our policy on Huawei and this 5G rollout, then I think we should expect other things to start being targeted as well.
We'll come back to all that shortly, but I want to go back to the root cause of this, which is the decision to disinclude Huawei from the 5G network. This is a result of concerns raised by the GCSB, New Zealand Spook Service. What are they actually worried about?
Well, they won't really say. You ask the GCSB what the problem is with Huawei, and they'll just say, oh, look, you know, there have been concerns raised by our counterparts in the United States, by our counterparts in the UK, by our counterparts in Australia. The Five Eyes Network, it's called, which is this, you know, all those five nations joining together to create one massive big sort of spying, the big spook network. And if those partners have got concerns about Huawei building a 5G network in New Zealand, then they tell the GCSB. The GCSB told the government there's laws and stuff that the previous government implemented, which means they can block Huawei from rolling this out. And that's exactly what they've done. The government says, no, Huawei, you cannot build this. Our spooks have got concerns, and those concerns are linked back to the concerns of the United States. So China's taken this as a massive intentional snubbing. New Zealand, I guess, siding with the United States, it probably can be seen as.
Well, on the subject of warning shots then, and you mentioned that New Zealand is not the only country worried about Huawei. Australia has expressed similar reservations and indeed has at the very least considered and I think is implementing a similar ban. Is China assuming that Australia will interpret this as a warning as well, that maybe they're picking off the small country first?
Yeah, mate. Yeah, possibly. I mean, we are a lot smaller than Australia. There's only less than 5 million people living in New Zealand. Australia's, what, got 25 million people?
Thereabouts.
And I guess Australia gives a lot more to China than Australia gives a lot of steel, doesn't it? A lot of iron ore or steel to China, and China needs that. Whereas I guess China can get its food products from other places. So it will hurt New Zealand a lot more than it would hurt Australia. But I mean, who knows? It really does depend. At the moment, it looks as though China's just trying to make New Zealand hurt a little bit. It's giving us a bit of a a bit of a Chinese burn on our arm, so to speak. And who knows what will be next? There is actually articles that I've seen in New Zealand about business leaders should be worried about being in China, that they could be detained and held by the Chinese government or not let in or not let out.
If one looks at what has occurred to a couple of Canadian businessmen in recent times over a related argument, this being the detention of the Huawei executive in Vancouver, it's not an unreasonable worry, I don't think. We were talking earlier about where this could end. There was also the story, this bizarre story this week, about an Air New Zealand flight from Auckland to Shanghai being abruptly turned around because it claimed that somewhere on the aircraft's voluminous paperwork, the cursed word Taiwan was mentioned. Now, is it possible to see that in any other way other than as part of this?
I think it would be, China cannot really deny it. It's hard for them to deny it. I mean, they are denying that it had anything to do with the New Zealand-China relationship and stuff like that, and the fact that Huawei was denied. But you've got, it's absolutely bizarre that Air New Zealand had a scheduled flight to Shanghai. They were flying a Boeing 787 aircraft, but they were flying an aircraft that the registration of that aircraft hadn't been authorised by China. And China just said, "Hey, look, we're just looking at our paperwork, and that particular aircraft didn't have permission to land at our airport." Now that is nitpicking, and they've done this nitpicking before. They've done this on numerous occasions. One of the occasions was steel dumping. The previous government launched an investigation into allegations that China was dumping all of its poor quality steel in New Zealand, and we were building bridges and all these things out of it, and the steel wasn't strong enough, and there was a whole lot of issues with construction in New Zealand. And so as soon as those allegations went up, then they started putting tighter controls on the paperwork around zespri kiwi fruit going into China. There's also, when different ministries in New Zealand changed their names, they put on different stricter stuff around paperwork regarding when the Ministry of Agriculture and Fisheries changed to the Ministry of Primary Industry. So China does this when things are getting tense, when they want to send a message to New Zealand, and that's exactly what they've done with this Air New Zealand example. And I think it goes right directly back to that Huawei decision.
Well, I think a clearer example of that is the postponement, as indeed it is for the moment, of Jacinda Ardern's visit to China. This does place her in a curious position domestically. How does it play for her in terms of domestic politics? Is standing up to China going to be something she can do in the assumption that she's got the Kiwi public behind her?
Yeah, absolutely. No one bullies New Zealand in its foreign policy, and there have been numerous examples over the last couple of decades of that. Our anti-nuclear stance is one of them. But there's always been this debate around where New Zealand sits between the United States, our historical allies. We've been allies with them in the World War One, World War Two, all the different wars in Korea and Vietnam, mm-hmm. and stuff like that. And then China, which is sort of our new trade ally. They're the ones that we make a lot of money from, and our exporters survive. So there's this big argument there. So I don't think New Zealanders would mind really which way Jacinda Ardern or her government goes, as long as they're taking a foreign policy approach that's got evidence behind it. And this Huawei decision does seem to have evidence behind it. But one thing I'll say regarding the snub budget, but the fact Jacinda Ardern hasn't been to China. When I was a political reporter in New Zealand, I went to China 3 times in the space of 2 years with our Prime Minister, so it was hugely important. And John Key, at that stage, was treated like royalty in China. And the fact that Jacinda Ardern's been, she's halfway through her first term as Prime Minister, and she hasn't even been to China yet, that sort of speaks volumes about where this relationship is at. So I think that behind the scenes, things are very tense.
Lloyd Burr from News Hub, thanks as always for joining us. You're listening to The Daily.
What is it like to be a city forgotten and rediscovered? Monocle Films travels to Gunsan in South Korea to bear witness to its urban revival. Here, natives and newcomers are creating quirky bars, art spaces, and a bright future for this charming coastal outpost. Gunsan, building on the past, playing now in the film section at monocle.com.
You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24, and for this week's episode of Tall Stories, we are heading to Rio de Janeiro, from where Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco is just back. In this edition, he tells us all about the Copacabana Palace, an icon of Brazilian glamour that's standing the test of time and remains the place to be in the city. Here is Fernando with more.
At the Copacabana, the high An icon of Brazilian glamour, the Copacabana Palace opened its doors in 1923 and remains intrinsically connected to Rio's fun party scene, hosting legendary carnival parties. The hotel was even the backdrop of a 1933 Hollywood musical featuring Ginger Rogers and Fred Astaire, and illustrious guests have ranged from Marilyn Monroe to Bill Clinton. Every time I return to my homeland, I make sure to visit Rio. Sometimes I stay with friends or in hotels, but shockingly, never stayed at the famous Copa, as locals like to call it. Well, not anymore. On my recent trip to Brazil, I decided to stay there for 2 nights with my partner to understand the myth behind, and I wasn't disappointed. In recent years, Rio welcomed a great selection of fantastic hotels. Recent openings include Arpoador Inn, Emiliano, Janeiro Hotel, among others. But I don't think the Copa is very worried. The Art Deco Hotel has recently been revamped. Overall, there are 239 rooms and all the furniture is made from Brazilian teak and mahogany wood. I find the rooms were elegant and roomy. But one thing that really impressed me was the amazing customer service and overall friendliness of the staff. It makes it for a special experience. Even in the busy summer season, they were not bothered by my very early check-in, for example. And in all the rooms of the hotel, you can smell a whiff of lemongrass. Apparently, you can buy the product in their spa. The pool of the hotel is glorious. Drinking a caipirinha while listening to many birds chirping at the hotel is priceless. Be early though, there is a Germanic attitude when it comes to grabbing a nice lounger by the pool. The breakfast was very special, with all the fruits you can imagine, plus Brazilian favorites such as pão de queijo, which is some sort of cheesy bread, and other options of bread. Brazilians adore bread, and so do I. I'm so glad we're not yet a granola or avocado toast nation. Although Ipanema offers an overall cooler and sexier vibe than Copacabana, it's worth staying at the latter only because of this magnificent hotel. I'll be very happy having all my meals at the beautiful room with a painted wall of palm trees and tropical birds and gentle bossa nova playing in the background.
Our thanks to Fernando Augusto Pacheco for today's episode of Tall Stories. Remember to tune in tomorrow at 1900 UK time for the full 30-minute edition of The Urbanist. You can, of course, catch up with that or all our other programming anytime you like on our website. You're listening to The Daily. This is The Daily with me, Andrew Muller. Time now to take a look at the Asian newspapers. We are joined by David Schlesinger, former editor-in-chief of Reuters and an expert on China. David, we start with the Global Times. That's a disconcerting headline. It says, Beijing readies for possible high-tech Cold War. Must we?
Well, I included this because I think it's really important for us to remember that whatever you hear about the trade war currently going on between China and the U.S., the negotiations, whatever happens on intellectual property or actual trade numbers, the real battle isn't about 2019. It's about 2030, 2040, 2050, and who's going to dominate the world economy. And that's going to depend on who dominates artificial intelligence, who dominates 5G. And at the moment, China's putting the money in. The U.S. has put out a new strategic paper, but it's actually China that's putting the investment in and trying to make real gains.
The Chinese Communist Party famously plays a long game in a way that few Western political parties do. I guess the Chinese Communist Party, recognizing they don't have to waste time and energy worrying about getting re-elected, can take the broader view. But is there a coherent yet sense of a vision of what they see this new world looking like, you know, at one of those dates, at 2030, 2040?
Well, I think what China wants to do is take all the big data that it can get from having such a huge population and having apps throughout its population and really use that to develop new ways of developing technology, new types of robotics, new applications for the technology. And that's really what's going to run GDP from now on.
Okay, well, staying in China and maintaining the theme of enormous, ambitious, expansionist projects by China, this is a story from the China Daily, looking ahead to what it says is the blueprint for the Bay Area, what it says it will turn, and I quote, the Guangdong, Hong Kong, Macau, Greater Bay Area into a global economic powerhouse. Now, is there also an aspect of this that is going to basically turn Hong Kong and Macau into just two more Chinese cities rather than special cases?
Yes, and I think that's the downside for Hong Kong in particular. The upside is that this huge conurbation would have about 69 million people, so more people than in the entire United Kingdom. And to connect with the story we just did, it already is a powerhouse in terms of Internet of Things and artificial intelligence. A lot of that development and manufacturing is going on in Shenzhen right now. So if China can actually deliver on this promise of this huge new urban area that already rivals Tokyo and New York, greater areas in terms of economic production, that's really quite a powerhouse.
It is an extraordinary prospect, but on the political considerations, to the extent that the Chinese Communist Party is obliged to consider them, would they be anticipating much pushback from the people of Macau and Hong Kong? Because this is not looking good for the whole one country, two systems thing, is it?
No, I mean, it's very similar, in fact, to the argument that we have here about the European Union. If you really want to have borderless trade, if you want to have one economy in an area, you give up a certain amount of autonomy. And that's going to hit Hong Kong in the areas that are important to it. Rule of law, decisions on who gets to come in and go out. Ways to run the court system, ways to run the government. These things all they'll have to sacrifice in order to have this greater Bay Area conurbation.
Okay, well, let's move along to the Bangkok Post, which makes an attempt to explain Thai politics. I mean, with all due respect to the great nation of Thailand, its politics are often difficult to distinguish from any given circus. But this has been extraordinary. We had the princess, or a princess, announcing that she was going to have a crack at running for prime minister, only to be overruled by the king. And now we're trying to figure out why that happened or why it stopped and what it all means.
Well, it seems to have been a huge blunder by the forces aligned with former Prime Minister Thaksin. That party actually put the princess forward. There was an assumption for about 24 hours that, oh, if the princess put her name forward, the king must be in agreement. The king then slapped it down in no uncertain terms. And in this story from the Bangkok Post, it looks like that party may now be disbanded. So it looks like quite a bad political blunder. All this in the run-up to elections next month, March 24th, the first elections after 5 years of this coup.
Do we know yet, though, who it specifically was a blunder by or how they thought this was going to work? Because this does seem like one of those ideas at which, at whatever meeting decided upon it, nobody asked the question, what could go wrong?
I certainly don't have insight into that. I'm not sure that anybody does. But yes, you would have assumed that someone would have asked the question, what's the king going to think about this? And either the king had implied he'd be okay with it, or the king didn't know about it at all, which would be a bit extraordinary, or someone changed their mind at the last minute. But whatever happened, it's been several days of high drama and a real mess.
Moving along to the Philippines, this is a story in Rappler, and this is a story that I mentioned earlier in the news summary, and this is one of the unhappy occasions of a news outlet having to cover itself being a massive story. The opening sentence is a masterpiece of understatement. Intrigued by the timing of Maria Ressa's arrest warrant, many netizens saw it as a desperate move to silence the press. I'll bet they did. Is that a... I mean, obviously, Rappler is possibly a somewhat partial observer here, but that's a, not an unreasonable assessment, is it?
Not at all. Maria Ressa is a terrific journalist. Her background from CNN, she started Rappler, hard-hitting, investigative, but has gotten on the wrong side of President Duterte, who has really tried to harass her by every means possible. He's brought tax evasion charges against her, which could put her in prison for a long time. And now in this latest incident, he's charging her under a cyber libel law. But this is so clearly just a game, because that law actually came into effect 4 months after the story that she's being accused about. So this is
a story which ran, we should note, 7 years ago.
Yes.
I mean, it's one of those things that makes me wonder, if we take as read that this is obviously an attempt by President Duterte to intimidate a media outlet he finds disagreeable, is the fact that he's doing it on an obviously ludicrous basis actually part of his strategy? This is him just saying, I'm doing this because I can do this. I can pick the most ludicrous, you know, unsustainable bureaucratic point to nail you on, and I'm going to do it to demonstrate that I can do it.
Well, I think if you look around the world at the moment, we have a lot of strongman bullying governments where the leaders like to say, I decide what the law is, and I'm going to use it in my favor. And I think this is another example of that, someone taking a law and using it as a stick.
Is there much chance at all of Rappler getting out from under this, do you think? I mean, it will at least have that thing that is known as the Streisand effect, that this will bring down vastly more attention upon Rappler than otherwise there would have been. I mean, we wouldn't be talking about Rappler right now, most likely.
Right, and Maria Ressa is a figure who, she's won a number of awards just in the past year. She was one of the Time Men of the Year, or Time People of the Year, won an award from the Committee to Protect Journalists, several other organizations as well. So a very high-profile case. But who's going to come to her defense other than people like you and me?
And moving finally along to the South China Morning Post, this demonstrating that social media outrage against tone-deaf advertising has become a universal phenomenon. This is a Chinese firm insisting that their coconut milk drink will make women's breasts bigger. I'm not a medical expert, but I'm pretty sure that's not how it works.
I would agree with you. I think the reason I included this story is that with all the terrible things happening in the world, one of the things that does give me a bit of hope is that the current generation that is online, that uses social media, does rise up against tone-deaf businesses, tone-deaf advertisers, tone-deaf government officials. That's something to hang on to when otherwise there's a lot of bad news around.
In line, though, with what we were talking about previously, there is also part of me that wonders if businesses are starting to actually realize this is a way to amplify advertising. If you do something crass and stupid, people talk about it way more than they otherwise would.
They'll talk about it. I'm not sure if they'll buy you.
The question as to why anybody would voluntarily drink coconut milk is one to which I have not heard a satisfactory answer.
I drink coconut milk, but this is not television, so your your audience can have to use their imagination about what it has done to my bust.
David Schlesinger, thank you for joining us. You're listening to The Daily. Finally on tonight's show, we hear from the legendary Brazilian musician Sergio Mendes. The bossa nova artist has more than 55 albums under his belt and is one of Brazil's most successful musical exports. He'll be releasing a new album later this year. There's also a documentary about his life in the works as well. Well, earlier, Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke with Sergio Mendes about his upcoming show in the UK as part of the Cheltenham Jazz Festival, taking place in May.
Mas que nada sai da minha frente que eu quero passar. Pois o samba está animado.
I call our show is The Musical Journey, because we cover the early, the great songs from the bossa nova period, which I was part of it. You know, the great classics from Jobim and also songs from Brazil 66, songs from more recent songs that I did was Will I Am and the Black Eyed Peas and all those songs. So it's a journey. It's a musical journey. So we have a great percussionist from Brazil. We have two singers, two girl singers. The band is fantastic, and I'm really excited to go back to England and to the UK and do a little tour there. Very nice. I love the country and the culture and the people.
And, you know, Sergio, one of the amazing things of your music that, you know, you're always collaborating, like, with up-and-coming and new artists as well. Do you think that's quite important for you, those type of collaborations?
Yeah, very important. I love, you know, music is the, you know, universal language. And it's a wonderful thing for me to go to a studio and play with other musicians, with other people. And I've done that for a long time. Even when I started, I came to the United States for the Bossa Nova Festival in 1962, and I was invited to do an album with Cannonball Adderley, and for me it was such a joy to work with him and, you know, and other musicians in my life that I work with. It, you know, it's just been a wonderful experience, and I love that. The record I did was Will.i.am and Justin Timberlake, John Legend, you know, Jill Scott. It's just a sharing experience. It's just beautiful, and I love it. I'm doing a new album right now, and there's a lot of collaborations. I recorded songs from Hermeto Pascoal, from Ginga, from my favorite composers in Brazil. Last week, I just did a track here in L.A. with Common, which is a very wonderful, he's a rapper. So I like that very much, working with different people at different times. And actually, I was asking my wife here today, because I'm very excited to play at Royal Albert Hall. And I asked her, I said, when was the last time we played at Albert Hall? She said, 1980. We're the opening act for Frank Sinatra. And we did 10 days at Albert Hall. And I was such, for me, it was such a, both things, you know, working with him and being at Albert Hall. So, you know, I'm looking for all those experiences again and to be in England and have a great party.
And you mentioned the album. So when is the album out? Just so the fans can
the
know.
The album will be coming out mid-April, late April. And I have a lot of guests. I'm very excited about that. And I also have a documentary about my life that's been done by a man named John Scheinfeld. He did John Coltrane. He did John Lennon. And so we went to Brazil. We recorded, interviewed a lot of people down there. Same thing here in the United States. A lot of footage from the old days. So we're going to have the documentary and the record coming at the same time, early spring.
And Sergio, I would like to ask you, I mean, I know you lived outside of Brazil, you know, for a long time, but you're very much still a representation of Brazil for many people, especially when it comes to music. How comfortable do you feel about that? Are you still very much connected?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I just came back. I spent Christmas and New Year's down there, many friends, and I'm always in touch with the music and the musicians, my friends. And, you know, today that distance is much shorter with the internet and all of that. No, I'm constant because for me it's very important. And for all the years that I've been living here, that's my residence. But, you know, there's a huge part of me that's Brazilian. You know, I spent half of my life down there. And, oh, yeah.
Do you follow the work, for example, of young Brazilian musicians, of what's happening in the world of Brazilian music today?
Yeah, in the way I can, because, you know, today with the internet and, you know, I can watch television shows in Brazil and people send me records. So I'm always in touch.
And finally, Sergio, I would like to know, like, because, you know, I'm a big fan of yours. Tell us, for example, one of the tracks that you'll be playing here that you know, that is very special for you, for example.
All the songs are very special for me because they represent different periods of my life. But of course, the, you know, Masquinada continues to be the biggest hit, and we close the show with that and people dancing and just a wonderful party and celebration of life.
That was Sergio Mendes speaking to Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And for those in the UK, Mendes will be playing at the Cheltenham Jazz Festival on May 4th. That is it for today's edition of The Daily. It was produced by Tom Hall and Carlotta Ribello. The researchers were Daphne Karnesis and Teresa Marvulli. Our studio manager was Sarah Miles. The Globalist is here 8 hours from now with Emma Nelson. The Daily returns at the same time tomorrow. I'll be your host for that as well. I'm Andrew Miller. Thanks for listening.